Okay, hi everybody. We are beginning with Laws of the Soul webinar commentaries, Esoteric Psychology 2. We're in number 5. We're on page 95 and we're in the Law of Sacrifice. DK gives a lot of attention to each one of these laws in this particular book. The section is over, well over 100 pages in the book. So it's a most significant study for us. We will go on in this fifth section now. This law of sacrifice and the impulse to give, remember, the impulse of giving is the major theme of the law of sacrifice, can also be traced throughout every kingdom in nature. It is typified for us in the basic sacrifices, which take place between the various kingdoms. The essential qualities of the minerals and chemicals of the earth are an instance in point. They are needed by other forms of life and are donated to man through the medium of the vegetable kingdom, which of course absorb them. They are donated to man through the medium of the vegetable kingdom and through the water which he drinks, in which the minerals may be dissolved. And thus, even in the first and densest kingdom in nature, whose consciousness is so far removed from ours, does this process of giving hold good. But the tracing of this law of sacrifice in the subhuman kingdoms is not possible here, and we must confine our attention to the world of human living and consciousness. And of course, we can understand that the plant life sacrifices itself to the animal kingdom and to the human kingdom in terms of food, essentially, and to help to provide the oxygen which can be breathed and can sustain those forms of life. The animal kingdom is not meant to be sacrificed to the fourth kingdom in terms of food, but in terms of labor, yes. And there is a strange sense also in which the human kingdom is sacrificed to the fifth kingdom, the kingdom of souls. We're told in Rule 6 in the Rays and the Initiations that the fifth feeds upon the fourth, especially all that is of value produced by the fourth, all that is the higher product of the fourth. All right, we come to a new section now, and this is the work of salvage or salvation, generally taking something in an apparently unusable condition and finding a way to use and redeem, finding a way to use and redeem the apparently useless. All right, let's see if I can make this just a little smaller, I think. The law of sacrifice means also salvage, to find that which is redeemable, regardless of the condition. And, you know, even in the case of the Black Lodge, if there is any slight tendency or energy in the energy system of such individuals which is redeemable and which tends towards the good, then they are not totally lost, we are told, and some effort is made to build upon that which is still redeemable. So it means also salvage and underlies all the evolutionary processes, and particularly does this emerge into clear significance in the human family. This instinct to betterment, the urge to progress or progress, I guess, physical, emotional, and intellectual. The effort to ameliorate conditions, the tendency to philanthropy, which is so rapidly taking hold in the world. And this, we know, is a blending of the second aspect of divinity and the third aspect of divinity. And the sense of responsibility, which does make men realize that they are their brother's keeper. Of course, Cain was asked, where is his brother? He had killed his brother. Of course, there's an occult meaning to all that in terms of the chakras. Probably the relationship between the head center and the solar plexus center, between Vulcan and Mars. But Cain answered, am I my brother's keeper? And the answer here, given by DK, is yes. All these are expressions of this sacrificial instinct. So, in other words, we rise to higher quality through sacrifice. We give up something for a general improvement in our vibrational state. This is all a question of values and of what lower values can be sacrificed. For the emergence of higher values. This factor, though not unrecognized by modern psychology, is of far wider significance than has yet been realized. This sacrificial tendency towards betterment, because there is no betterment unless something lower is sacrificed for something higher. So, sacrificial tendency towards betterment, if we can call it that. So we have been dealing with the idea of being one's brother's keeper. All these are expressions of the sacrificial instinct because one has to give up the tendencies of one's lunar vehicles in order to achieve group consciousness. So the sense of responsibility, philanthropy, ameliorating conditions, all these tend towards group consciousness, which is the great factor in all these laws of the soul. So this is the sacrificial instinct with which, as souls, we are endowed, just as the instinct towards acquisition is native to the lunar vehicles. An inherent selfishness, the so-called original sin, we might say, is the sin of selfishness inherent in the lunar vehicles. So this factor, the sacrificial instinct, though not unrecognized by modern psychology, is a far wider significance than has yet been realized. It is, this is instilled in us from the very highest sources, the source itself. It is inherent in the monad. This instinctual tendency is the one that itself governs the law of rebirth, constantly to uplift and redeem and improve the condition of the lesser lives. So it's the elevation of vibration. It is the expression of a still greater factor in the creative process. It is the major determining impulse which impelled the soul of God himself to enter into form life. We might say the pervading of form life by the consciousness of God, which impels, it is the determining impulse which impels life upon the involutionary arc to progress downward, producing thus the immanence of God. And this is the first part of the descent of the monad, but also before that, descent of the third aspect of divinity and the second aspect of divinity. It is also that the sacrificial instinct, the instinct of giving, the instinct of making sacred, it is also that which drives humanity forward into its wild struggle for material well-being. And let us say that this sensed as an improvement over conditions as they were before. Stark, difficult, inhospitable. It is that too which urges man eventually to turn his back upon the world, the flesh, and the devil, the three aspects of divinity, as the New Testament puts it, and orient himself to the things of spiritual import. So there is an involutionary descent of consciousness into matter, much at the expense of consciousness, but for the general upliftment in matter, this general infusion of a higher aspect into a lower aspect. The prodigal son sacrificed the father's home, indeed, when he chose to wander forth into the far country. Now this, we could say, this is a sacrificial gesture. He wasted and sacrificed his substance through the use he made of the experience of life on earth until he had exhausted all his resources and there was naught left but the eventual sacrifice of what he held so dear but had discovered to be so unsatisfying. Well, this is the story of every one of us. We sacrifice our high consciousness and energy prerogatives of the higher planes in order to redeem the lower lives, and then we sacrifice our attachment to those lower lives, returning, and as we return, lifting them as well, on the way to the Father's home. The red cattle of Geryon in the labors of Hercules, the red cattle prompted always by desire but uplifted in a chalice towards a higher type of life. So some things were considered to be extremely dissatisfying. And did we really long for these things? Was it desire that drove us into the lower worlds, or was it the high Piscean, Virgoan, second ray, sacrificial urge from the monadic plane? For these things of lesser value, he had sacrificed the higher values and had to return again whence he came. So we have here, in a way, the law of monadic return. Such is the life story of all sons of God who came into incarnation as given to us under the symbolism of the Bible and the prodigal son, but the theme in all the world Bibles is the same. So we are involved in a sacrificial pilgrimage, sacrificing the high for the low, and then again the low for the high, all in the attempt to make all aspects of life sacred, correspondent with divine purpose. We could say, well, could they not work their way up without the sacrifice? Well, I suppose, in a way, given the nature of life, they could. After all, a man in other chains and in other solar systems works his way into the higher world slowly without the intervention of the solar angels. And yet, millions of years of pain are saved because of the giving of these higher beings. I suppose that once we are in that state of realizing the unity, the inseparability of all lives, there is a deep spiritual longing to see an enhancement of that unity and its realization on the part of many lives who do not yet realize it, bringing them nearer to the goal through a divine intervention. We have been sometimes talking about sacrifice through divine intervention. It's the story of the Solar Angels, of Sanat Kumara, of our planetary logos, and of the World Savior. Whoever that World Savior might be, there is a deliberate act of intervention in the lives of those who otherwise would suffer longer in their ignorant and hampered condition. So we have to begin to understand the beauty of sacrifice. I became nothing there for a moment. The beauty of sacrifice. This must impress itself upon us as we study. And this form of relinquishment must be understood in terms of even understanding even the bliss of sacrifice, because of the nature of the energy of love. It is a loving gesture which contributes to the unification of all that the sacrificing one touches. So I suppose there comes a time in our evolution when we are actually looking for the next sacrifice that we can possibly make, rather than the next acquisition. We actually learn that sacrifice is spiritual acquisition, and that the grasping of spiritual delights guarantees a delay in their acquisition. Well, this is a great reversal of the attitude of the personality, and something that we have to get used to, and it does really begin to dawn upon us. One just gets flickers, glimmers of what must be the sacrificial consciousness of the Christ and of the Masters. How can we give more? How can we sacrifice more to elevate the lower lives? And we are, of course, relatively then the lower lives. How can we, the sacrificing ones, SACG, sacrificing ones. Yeah. So how can we, the sacrificing ones, give more and more and even more so that the lesser, or the, so that life in lesser expression can rise? There really is only one being in all of the apparent others. So we can't say in the other forms of life, there really is no other, but there is an apparent other that we must deal with when we are subject to the world illusion. So when have, as Master Moria says, when indeed have you ever become less through sacrifice? The instinct or the impulse really, towards giving. And this it is that controls the life of the soul and even more the life of the monad. Well, the monad is a being with consciousness on its own plane, and the soul as the monad with consciousness in a relatively hampered condition compared to the monadic plane. the impulse towards giving. I hope that can sink deeply into the consciousness of all of us. This urge to sacrifice, to relinquish this for that, to choose one way. Notice how Saturn is involved in choice, always involved in processes of choice, to choose one way or line of conduct and thus sacrifice another way because having it all is not yet possible in this fragmented world. To lose in order eventually to gain, that's the death process. And the eighth house process, Scorpio. Such is the underlying story of evolution. The urge to sacrifice, to give up, to relinquish this for that. As long as we are in a dualistic world, let's just say that this process is necessary in a dualistic and fragmented world, which confines our perceptions to specific things. Well, we're living through this, and this is the way we have to operate. Perhaps once we have a vast holistic consciousness and are infused in all the things we perceive, well, even then, sacrifice would be operative because we would descend into the world where that type of holistic perception is not possible, and we would take on vehicles and circumstances in which fragmentation still existed. But anyway, this urge to sacrifice, to relinquish this for that, to choose one way or line of conduct and thus sacrifice another way, to lose in order eventually to gain. A man must lose his life to find it, right? Didn't the Scorpio St. Paul say that? A man must lose his life in order to find it. Such is the underlying story of evolution. And, you know, if we were really brave about our spiritual work, we would say, okay, what is my next sacrifice? Not only to better myself, but to better all those whose lives my life touches. What is my next sacrifice? Probably few of us are inclined to speak to ourselves that way, but it would be an interesting process. What can I now relinquish in order that there be greater abundance for those whom I serve? And incidentally, it will happen, of course, also for myself. Such is the underlying story of evolution. This needs psychological understanding because it's such a, you know, such a reversal of the usual attitude. It is a governing principle of life itself, or of pure being, of the identity of God itself, we could say. Of God itself, and runs like a golden pattern of beauty through the dark materials of which human history is constructed. The moments of progressive, well, of sacrifice which bring progress. And without those moments, we would be stuck in acquisition and in selfishness, and we would remain attached to the lower worlds. So, when this urge to sacrifice in order to win, gain, or salvage that which is deemed desirable is understood, then the whole clue to man's unfoldment will stand revealed. There are so many things along the way that we have to let drop from our hands. Sometimes we have outgrown what we let drop from our hands, but at other times the desire to hold on still exists. And yet, in the face of that desire, we still let that something drop from our hands. Well, that is, when you let drop from your hands something that at the moment you still hold dear, then that is a real sacrifice, or something that is really needed for the welfare of some aspect of yourself. One's reminded of the widow's mite. Really, anything we give is a mite, really. But the Christ said, in the temple she hath given all she hath. And others have given far more, but they did not give from the very depths of themselves. And it cost them relatively nothing. And therefore their progress was relatively small. One can imagine that that particular widow of long ago is far advanced on the path at this time, having done what was so estimable, you know, in the eyes of the great teacher. So when the surge to sacrifice in order to win, gain, or salvage that which is deemed desirable is understood, then the whole clue to man's unfoldment will stand revealed. And I guess, you know, we can ask ourselves at any moment, we could say, what am I hanging on to? Such English. What am I hanging on to which, released, would benefit others and myself? Well, this is something that one has to take into one's own deep consideration, and may find, of course, that it's not material objects at all, but can be certain attitudes, certain tendencies of thought, certain perceptions. We're all attached to certain things which, if relinquished, could bring an inflow of energy of a much higher value. But it's for each one of us to discover what that might be. This tendency or urge is something different to desire, as desire is academically understood and studied today. Well, I think he's saying here already that the soul has its desires, and so does the monad. We cannot really drop desire, but we can make it, as Master Moria says, goal fit. Marvelous books, those Agni Yoga books, you know. I remember I discovered them really about 35 years ago, 36 years ago. I just was entranced and made my commute to New York City 2 hours in each direction every weekday tolerable. Agni Yoga goes a long way when you are riding a train, a bus, a subway, or walking through the crowded streets, listening. So this tendency or this urge to sacrifice coming from a very deep and high place within ourselves is something different from desire as academically understood. What it really connotes is the emergence of that which is most divine in man. Well, the spirit wishes to give of itself until all things become itself or recognize themselves as itself. It is an aspect of desire, but it is the dynamic, active side, and not the feeling, sensuous side. It is the predominant characteristic of deity. Let's just say that deity realizes itself as disunited from the whole. And it is sacrifice which will reunite the whole. So giving up that which makes us perceive in a lesser way for the onset of higher perceptions. So what is it that keeps my consciousness in ignorance, keeps me confined to customary assessments, customary perceptions and understandings? Can I sacrifice those mindsets, those attitudes of desire and mind? Can I sacrifice my habits? Can I relinquish? Notice that DK does not abandon the idea of relinquishment. As I say, so many of us may try to sugarcoat the idea of sacrifice so that it becomes palatable to the frightened personality, frightened in the face of what it might have to relinquish. And then one never has to face the removal of that which the grasping hands still seek to grasp. When you look upon a great individual, or any great life, a status is achieved through sacrifice. So, spiritual status is achieved through sacrifice, and those who are lowly and yet should be higher have not sacrificed. Of course, life itself forces us to sacrifice. The divine plan forces sacrifice in every sacrifice petal. But the voluntary sacrifice is far more powerful for progress. So again, as the Christ said, he who would be first, let him be last. The first shall be last. Of course, it's also an astrological, zodiacal statement about the union of the end of the cycle and the beginning of the cycle. But he who would be first among you, let him serve. So let the one humble himself who would be first. Let the one who gives most shall be highest. That is the amazing truth. And that's something we really have to bring into our consciousness, because which one of us could not give more? If we were giving all we had, we wouldn't be where we are now. And on the way to renunciation and crucifixion and elevation, we shall certainly give all we have to give. It's just a question of timing. When will it be? We might as well get into the habit of giving, following the impulse of giving. That is the touchstone. That is the golden key to understanding the nature of sacrifice. This foundational law really lies at the center of every other law. There must always be this line of sacrifice running through all the other laws. It's like the number one, which is divisible into all the other numbers. The point finds its way into every other point. So sacrifice is our keynote. It has been our keynote without our understanding it. Now that it needs to be our conscious keynote. It is of interest, however, for students of esotericism to note that this urge to salvage and to sacrifice in order to redeem works out in different ways, in different planetary schemes. Well, it would be mostly those who are students of esotericism who would be interested in such things. You say, well, you talk to the average person about relinquishing and say, well, you know, it's quite different on Venus, quite different on Uranus than it is here. They might think that your mind had departed. So it works out in different ways in different planetary schemes according to the objectives of a particular planetary logos and the laws operative in any of those schemes. Each ray lord of a scheme, notice how a ray lord and a planetary logos are pretty well connected, are they not? Sometimes we might think that a ray lord is other than a planetary logos, and indeed there are many ray lords who are. A ray as a being can be disconnected from any particular manifestation, but the logos of a planet is known as a ray lord. So let's note that. Note that a planetary logos is known as a ray lord. So each ray lord of a scheme manifesting through a planet expresses this urge to sacrifice in varying ways. And each expression is so different from the others that it is hard for a human being to do more than sense that methods which exist, than sense that method which exists on our own particular planet. Well, sacrifice is hard enough to understand, even here. Hard to understand even on our planet, let alone others. Initiates know that the varying psychological characteristics of the ray lives condition most peculiarly the method of expressing sacrifice during the course of manifestation. Rather deep subject, and I'm not sure that we can penetrate into that. I mean, well, you know, when we think about sacrifice in Saturn, we know something about it. But the Saturnian method is pretty close to our own because Saturn, Mars, and the Earth are intimately related as expressions of a great third ray entity. We might say sacrifice in relation to Saturn is pretty much not this but that. Sacrifice in relation to Mars has to do with self-immolation. Sacrifice in relation to the Earth, well, maybe we will learn more. There's something about uniting, at oneing the pairs of opposites. Possibly. Here is where we begin to understand the depth of knowledge of Master DK and of masters who have access to the records. Their consciousness has extended beyond the processes of our planet, and they take deep interest in how the other planets are related to our own. So the varying psychological characteristics of the ray lives condition most peculiarly the method of expressing sacrifice during the course of manifestation, but all do express sacrifice in one way or another. The great stream of living energy which is manifesting itself in our Earth scheme of evolution is conditioned by a temperament, an attitude, and an orientation that is that of a divine rebel. One might almost think we were speaking of Mars in this respect. We have to remember here that the monadic ray of our planetary logos is the first. And it does not inherently brook restraint. The first ray and the sixth ray are those that do not brook or tolerate that which attempts to hold them in some sort of suppressed condition, in some condition of non-expression. The great stream of living energy which is manifesting itself in our Earth scheme, the energy of our planetary logos, is conditioned by a temperament, an attitude, and an orientation as that of the divine rebel. And perhaps there was a rebellion, we're told, in the previous solar system, and you almost think that it was our Earth our Earth logos and his expressions which were involved in that rebellion. So we can ask, were the planetary logos of the Earth and his expressions in the last solar system involved in the rebellion within that system? Is that the way it happened? DK is very oblique about this rebellion which occurred, and he doesn't tell us what planet, but we can just pretty well connect the idea of the divine rebel with an earlier rebellion against a higher law, which accounts for so much difficulty in this system and perhaps has paved the way for the karmic circumstance of our particular planetary logos. It is only rebellion that produces pain and sorrow. But this rebellion is inherent and innate in the deity of our planet himself and the one in whom we live and move and have our being. Well, let's just say that true acquiescence, does not cause pain. The devas are acquiescent. The devas are acquiescent, and they do not grow through pain so much as we do. They grow through the joy of what they build themselves into, through appreciation of beauty, through participation in form. They grow in different ways. We, the human family, which I think has a great deal of first ray in it, maybe on the monadic level, shatters the forms and rebels against containment. You kind of wonder, though, whether the spirit itself, when faced with confinement in form, does not automatically turn rebellious, at least the spirit of the monads, which are human in nature. In general, I would think this would be true of spirit no matter what. So it is only rebellion that produces pain and sorrow, because rebellion causes a rending process. This is pain and sorrow relate to a rending and tearing process. And rebellion against confining form causes a tearing, a rending of that form. If we're perfectly content in the circumstances in which we find ourselves and do not push against the limits, push against the boundaries, well, we avoid friction. So let's just say that rebellion and friction are inseparable. And that's why I also think that Mars has a strong quality there of resistance as well. It is one of the most frictional planets. It asserts itself against limits. It appears that our planetary logos does too. I kind of wonder whether the monadic ray of both of them is not the first. We know that the monadic ray of the Earth is the first, and we understand that the fifth ray is very highly placed in Mars. It's really more of an orange planet, but five has to resolve to something, doesn't it? Because we cannot have a monadic ray on the rays of attribute, ultimately. So I wonder if it doesn't resolve to the first ray in this school for warriors and the school which trains destroyers, as we are told. First ray has to be somewhere. Maybe in its soul nature. If it was in its monadic nature too, it would be extremely destructive. But we're not given to know entirely those higher ray combinations. So it is only rebellion that produces pain and sorrow, but this rebellion is inherent and innate in the deity of our planet. By that I assume we mean our planetary scheme, the one in whom we live and move and have our being, not just our globe lord, not just our chain lord, but our planetary scheme. It is therefore a tendency greater than the individual unit, and we might say that we all, as earthlings, are imbued by this tendency towards rebellion. It is only possible to express this amazing truth about the planetary life under a veil of symbology and in terms of human thought. Well, the deeper truth is far more than we can grasp, really. In this, there is ever a risk for men interpret all they read and hear and experience in terms of themselves. So this is anthropomorphism, seeing all other forms in terms of the human form. Seeing all processes in terms of what's transpiring with us, because what else do we have as a reference point? We understand something about what's happening to ourselves, and we don't understand how different it might be elsewhere. So this projection of our own psychology upon and our own process upon the processes found elsewhere in other beings is a great limitation. I'm sure there are parallels, but there are some powerful differences which we may not comprehend at all, not yet. So anyway, he seems to be relating sacrifice, pain, sorrow, and rebellion. I suppose it is this attitude of the rebel that makes us want to return as the prodigal son, feeling that our inner nature has suffered a great indignity in its confinement. Even the servants in my father's house have more than I have, and I am the son, he was saying to himself. Is it rebellion that makes the monad go forth sacrificially into the lower worlds? Well, it's more difficult to understand rebellion at that level than it is in terms of the prodigal son returning. Against what are we rebelling? We certainly all feel confinement to some extent, and we're probably not willing to tolerate that forever, which is the reason we are taking pains with our spiritual studies and esoteric meditation to scientifically work our way out of this condition of spirit restraint and return to a much freer condition where our own will, the will of being, the will of spirit, will have its sway and will not be imposed upon. Really, the true spirit, the true being, than which there is no other, has no other to impose anything upon it. So the natural condition of the spirit is one of untrammeled will, a will which cannot be resisted because there's none other to resist. But in our very confined conditions in the lower worlds, we will not tolerate, we will not brook the apparent confinements. And so we attempt to throw them off. And we have a revolution. Rebellion leads to revolution. So now let us study what the old commentary says about the about our planetary logos, the divine rebel. And this is in solar systemic terms. He entered into life, presumably the life of the cosmic physical plane, and knew it to be death. The life of the cosmic physical plane, because after all, there is much more to the life of a planetary logos than can be found on the cosmic physical plane, which is density from his point of view. He knew it to be the death of his consciousness and death to the scope for expression of his abilities that he could enjoy on other and less hampered planes. He entered into density. He took a form and grieved to find it dark. Of what nature is planetary logoic grief? Is this simply an anthropomorphic statement helping us relate what the great logos experience to what we experience? It is the case that when in joy one goes forth to assist, one finds more difficult circumstances than one may have imagined. I remember reading about the first night that Father Damien experienced on Molokai Island. I think it was a moment of realization for him. I can't remember where I read it. I was studying him from the point of view of his horoscope and of the fourth degree. Interesting how powerful Vulcan was in his chart, needed to be for what he did. He was a Capricorn person, the third degree, with Taurus and Vulcan pointing to the fourth, ruled by the fourth ray as Taurus brings in the fourth ray. So I was studying that, and he had quite a grief-filled first night on that island, realizing he was indeed sacrificing everything he had for those who had contracted leprosy and were banished to that particular Hawaiian island to be rid of them, to get them away from others so others would not be contaminated by them. You know, as we see in the Bible, the phrase unclean, unclean is used with respect to the lepers. Untouchables, really, in terms of the normal human conception. So there he was, giving up everything he had achieved in terms of, let's say, being a rich young man, a third degree initiate, I suspect, and having many things open to him. It's a bit like Albert Schweitzer. He had all of Europe open to him as a musician, a builder of great organs, you know, all the multiple keyboards, a theologian, a recognized philosopher, had everything. But he went to Lambarene. This is a movement towards the fourth degree, wouldn't you say? He drove himself forth from the secret place and sought the place of light, and light revealed all that he sought the least. Well, he came forth from his soul nature into incarnation. The secret place is often the place of the soul. He came forth into incarnation and found it dark. He left the realm of the cosmic soul. And the light that was inherent in him revealed not what he had sought. but extreme confinement and tamas. Extreme confinement and tamas. Inertia and non-responsiveness. That's, you know, one goes forth to help and save and serve and realizes that the sphere into which one has entered to bring help, service, and saviorship just doesn't respond. So this is something one has to live through and has to find the ways to ensure that some response will be forthcoming, and that may take a lot of work. He craved permission to return. Well, every being has to ask permission of his superior. It's all a hierarchy in the universe. So we can just say this is an hierarchical universe. He sought the throne on high and him who sat thereon. And who would this be relative to a planetary logos? So this would be a solar logos. And he said, I sought not this. I looked for peace, for light. Well, like so many, you know, if we take it down to our own level, we may think that the sphere into which we are moving sacrificially is far less handicapped than we discover it to be. So I looked for peace, not for friction, for light, not for darkness, for scope to serve, and everything hampers me, to prove my love and reveal my power. But none of that, the environment resists that revelation, that love. And all is hampered and non-receptive. Light there is none. Not in the cosmic physical plane, especially in the densest levels of the cosmic physical plane, the lower 21 systemic subplanes. Light there is none. Peace is not found because there is a cacophony of inharmonious, dissonant, warring energies. Straight to the point, right? Let me return. Well, you know, he who has set his hand to the plow and seeks to return is not worthy to enter the kingdom of heaven. This is the great teaching the Christ gave on the human level. It seems also to apply. I wonder who would know this planetary psychology. I mean, how does any writer, unless of course the writer is the planetary logos himself in some way, how would any writer know what is in the psyche of the planetary logos? What would be the dissatisfaction? What would be the sense of rebellion? Would there be the desire to return? Well, we have to stay with those questions because we just don't know how anyone writing the old commentary would get into the psyche of the planetary logos. Light there is none, peace is not found. Let me return. But he who sat upon the throne turned not his head. It comes right back to the one who pleaded for escape. He seemed not e'en to listen nor to hear. There's no discussion here with the great soul of Logos about what the planetary duty may be. And sometimes when someone might go forth on a human mission that we have sent them upon, and they said, I really want to go back, I don't want this mission, could we adopt this attitude of letting them hear their own statement and not simply engaging in any form of persuasion, any form of dialogue? He seemed not e'en to listen nor to hear, but from the lower sphere of darkness. This is exactly like the sixth ray. This is so interesting. I'll show you this in a minute. But from the lower sphere of darkness and of pain, a voice came forth and cried, "We suffer here. We seek the light. We need the glory of an entering God." And DK says, "I can find no other words except these last two to express the ancient symbol from which I am translating. Lift us to heaven. Enter, O Lord, the tomb. Raise us into the light and make the sacrifice." Right. Make the sacrifice. Break down for us the prison wall and enter into pain. Very appealing prospect. And here is sacrifice on the level of the planetary logos. And we try to convince ourselves that there's no problem with sacrifice. It's not necessarily painful. You also hear this kind of New Ageism. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. Maybe not. We human beings will do so much to... We have this hatred of pain, you know, being a fourth-rate kingdom. And we do so much to make the hard places of life seem less hard, seem more tolerable, simply seem easier. But maybe it just isn't that way. We need the glory of an entering God. Make the sacrifice. Raise us into light. Break down for us the prison wall. We are prisoners of the planet. Free us. Come forth under Saturn and act the role of Uranus, if you know what I mean. So, come forth under obligation of Saturn and act as the liberating Uranus. Well, I want to go someplace with this. I want to go here to a similar situation for the human being, where he says, "How can I break my tunnel down? What shall I do?" This is an esoteric psychology under the law of repulse. Another pilgrim in the dark came up and, groping, found the follower. Well, let's just say that right before this, the follower is asking the deep voice that came from deep within his heart, the temple of his heart. This voice is speaking with clarity and, "Look deep within, around, on every side. The light is everywhere, within the heart, in me, the divine being, and all that breathes and all that is. Destroy thy tunnel which thou hast for ages long constructed. Stand free in custody of all the world." And then the follower answered, "How shall I break my tunnel down? How shall I find a way?" But, as in the case with the solar logos, no answer came. No answer from above, but an appeal from below, right? The voice rose, saying, "We need the glory of an entering God." And in this particular case, another pilgrim in the dark came up and, groping, found the follower. "Lead me and others to the light," he cried. The follower found no words, no indicated leader, no formulas of truth, no forms or ceremonies. He found himself a leader and drew others to the light that shone on every hand. So it is the lower voice, the voice of those in trouble, in difficulty, which evokes the compassionate response of the follower in this case, and of the planetary logos in the much higher case. So he worked and struggled forward. His hand held others, and for their sake he hid his shame, his fear, his hopelessness, and his despair. And he uttered words of surety and faith in life and light and God, in love and understanding. Well, maybe the passage of time is indicated by these dots. But anyway, it has the desirable effect. But when we look at what happens in the case of our planetary logos, well, His desire to return is offset by the compassion in his heart to those represented by the voice which says, we seek the light, we suffer here, we need the glory of an entering God. And then the cry, the appeal, the heart of the planetary logos responds. The voice says, lift us to heaven, enter, O Lord, the tomb. Well, usually we speak of resurrection and the freedom from the tomb, but now the sacrificing one is asked to enter the tomb and confine himself to the cold, to the darkness, to the lack of scope for conscious registration or expression. Raise us into the light and make the sacrifice. Well, the Soul Logos didn't have to say it, right? That's the amazing thing. The Soul Logos did not have to speak these words. Words were spoken, appealing to the compassion of the planetary logos. Break down for us the prison wall. And, you know, the alternative is not given. If you break the prison wall, you will enter into pain, but your compassion will draw you down into breaking the prison wall, and you must enter into pain, and you must make the sacrifice. So, for all who truly sacrifice, there is an entering into pain. So, perhaps a bit sadder, the Lord of Life returned following the obligation of his heart. He liked it not, and hence the pain. In other words, he held his post and yet sustained the inner attitude of rebellion. He liked it not, and hence the pain. I think I'll just read that all together. I'll find the place here. Entering God, there's only one. Find the unique words. So let's just read it and see if we can get the sense and how we might apply that to our own condition when we ask, what further sacrifice can I make at this time? Out of compassion, for the sake of love, for the sake of the growing unity and the upliftment of others. He entered into life and knew it to be death. He took a form and grieved to find it dark. He drove himself forth from the secret place and sought the place of light. And light revealed all that he had sought the least. He craved permission to return. He sought the throne on high and him who sat thereon. He said, I sought not this. I looked for peace, for light, for scope to serve, to prove my love and reveal my power. Light there is none. Peace is not found. Let me return. But he who sat upon the throne turned not his head. He seemed not e'en to listen nor to hear. But from the lower sphere of darkness and of pain, a voice came forth and cried, we suffer here. We seek the light. We need the glory of an entering God. I can find no other words except these last two to express the ancient symbol from which I am translating, says Master D.K. Lift us to heaven. Enter, O Lord, the tomb. Raise us into the light and make the sacrifice. Break down for us the prison wall and enter into pain. The Lord of Life returned. He liked it not, and hence the pain. So, again, we find that rebellion produces friction. The attitude of the divine rebel is sustained, but duty is stronger, and the great sacrifice persists. There are two, in a way, great sacrifices. This is about the planetary logos, not about Sanakumara per se, which is an emanation, a salvational emanation at a later stage in the planetary process. So we might say that Sanakumara is a salvational emanation at a later stage in the planetary process. Much later, really. So this is the condition of our planetary logos in this particular solar system. We don't know the condition, his condition, or the condition of the other planetary logoi and the other in the previous solar system, but we do know that if these logoi are as chakras of our solar logos, then they had to have been there as he is manifesting, because one manifests through the chakras. That is an interesting question. Are they independent beings, or are they really, in a sense, chakras of the solar logos? Did I say planetary? I meant solar logos. Solar logos. And if they are chakras, are they chakras on all the levels as well? Are they expressing as the astral chakras and the mental chakras, and there are going to be chakras beyond that as well? Well, they uphold in energy transmission a kind of chakric function. That much, in all simplicity, we can tell ourselves. So both the planetary logos and Sanakumara, who is an emanation of that logos, both have experienced sacrifice. Is Sanatkumara's attitude that of the divine rebel? Well, when we speak of Sanatkumara, we rarely speak that way. We speak of his astonishing patience. It's almost as if he is a great second ray emanation. But he will share in the psyche of the planetary logos, since as an emanation he is the planetary logos. But we have to remember the first ray nature of our planetary logos. And then inherent in every one of us, especially if a human being, this attitude of being the divine rebel. The same conditions which blend the law of sacrifice with pain and sorrow could be rather blended with bliss. This giving could be a blissful state, but at least on our planet it's a blending of sacrifice and giving with pain, sorrow, and difficulty are found also on the planet Mars and on the planet Saturn. They are not found on the other planets, so to sacrifice on the other planets, to sacrifice is not to fall into pain, sorrow, and difficulty. Let's put that down. On the planets, to sacrifice is not to fall into pain, sorrow, and difficulty. So they are not found on the other planets. Those who have read the Secret Doctrine and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire will, with understanding, of course, there is the caveat. We can read it. It can fall off the shelf and hit us on the head and say, read me. But do we read with understanding? You know, sometimes people get into it and say, whoa, what is this? I did most of my reading of the Secret Doctrine at 5 o'clock in the morning every morning before going to the Arcane School to work at the Lucis Trust. And like I have told my students, I underlined everything and understood nothing. But, you know, when you underline something, you feel that something is happening. I actually knew a fellow, a friend of mine, who really did underline every sentence in the books he was reading, the Bailey books. He had a lot of sixth ray. It's easy to be devoted to something. We've all experienced it without necessarily understanding what we're devoted to. But underlining is that sort of middle place between the mind and the page. And at least it signals to the mind, well, I must understand something, otherwise I wouldn't be underlining it, right? So it is a palliative, at least. One doesn't have to feel ignorant if one underlines something. Anyway, so pain, difficulty, sorrow, these are found on Mars and Saturn as well, and they tend to bring in our horoscopes the conditions of pain, difficulty, and sorrow in different ways. So those who have read the Secret Doctrine and Cosmic Fire with understanding know that our Earth is not a sacred planet. However, Mars, Saturn, and our Earth, well, Mars is not either, but Saturn is. Saturn, Mars, and our Earth constitute in a curious esoteric manner, and watch out for that word esoteric because it signals the world of the monad. In a curious esoteric manner constitute the personality of a stupendous ray life whose energy is that of the third ray. In my present attempt to understand this, I have considered this to be the third person of the Logoic Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, that great ray life who embodies or expresses the third ray through the mind, emotions, and physical vehicle, which actually are Saturn, Mars, and the Earth. Then there is the Sun, a great ray life, and the Father, a great ray life. The three persons of the Logoic Trinity. So he does say a stupendous ray life. Now, you know, is that life within our solar system? So far, I'm hypothesizing that it is. And we do wonder what the monadic rays are here. We know that the monadic ray of Saturn is the third and of Earth the first. Different lines can be drawn to the different planets from our Earth to the first ray monad of Uranus and our third ray personality to the great third ray of Saturn, monadically and otherwise. And from our second ray soul, the soul of the planetary logos, to the second ray soul of Jupiter. There are these not only lines of harmony, but lines of identicality. We have the identical monadic ray with Uranus and maybe Mars, and the identical soul ray with Jupiter. So these three planets constitute in a curious esoteric manner. We are not going to yet understand the personality of a stupendous ray life. Are there any planets that that somehow constitute his soul or his triadal vehicles? Well, this ray life has the third ray particularly, and the only other planet that I can think of that, well, there's two really that have third ray in their system. Mercury, definitely, and Uranus, apparently. Maybe to some degree, Pluto, in a way not expressed, but Pluto has so much about intrigue connected with it. Well, the third ray also touches the trident of Neptune. Of course, Saturn, and we've discussed that, and sometimes Venus has to do with higher mind, which seems to be the domain of the third ray, but there's not so much about Venus that we would be connecting normally with the third ray. There are, as has been stated elsewhere, 7 sacred planets, but 10 planetary schemes, even 12. And in 3 cases, those of the 3 major rays, 3 planets constitute the personality of each ray life. Well, this may be a little difficult to interpret. 7 sacred planets and 10 planetary schemes, and in 3 cases, those of the 3 major rays, and I have to say, you know, probably working through the 3 persons of the Logoic Trinity, 3 planets constitute the personality of each, because, you know, we might say, well, we should think that what we're really talking about is the synthesizing planets with 3 planets constituting the personality. But the synthesizing planets are included among the 3, because we're going to see in a minute that there's a group of 3 that are expressing the personality of another ray life, and Uranus is included. And then we can infer that maybe Neptune is included when expressing the personality of a great first ray life. After all, Neptune does bring dissolution and destruction at Prolaya. Each planet, we know, has a number of rays, and in trying to understand the deeper expression of the planets, these rays will have to be studied. But right now, it's a question of inference. Some esoteric thinkers believe that there are 12 planets to be considered in our solar system, and there is a basis for their conclusion. Let's just say 1 ruling each of the signs, in a sense. I think I've gone over this earlier in esoteric astrology, how the rulership could be worked out, and not necessarily an exoteric rulership. The personality of this third ray life functions through the following planets. So the third ray life, we have to assume, is not a synthesizing planet. Well, as I say, the personality of the ray life is one thing, but what about the soul nature in its triune aspect, and can we bring in the monadic nature, which is also triune through the spiritual triad and even on its own plane? I'm not sure that that makes complete sense at this point. But anyway, the personality of this third ray life functions through the following planets. The mental body expresses itself through the medium of the planet Saturn. Well, this is interesting. It's not necessarily that Saturn is the mental body, but the mental body of this, let's say, person of the Logoic Trinity expresses itself through the medium of Saturn. So we have to be careful how we read here. It is not necessarily that Saturn is the mental body of this great third ray life, but that the mental body of this life expresses through Saturn. Because Saturn, we realize, has many parts to it, not just a mental body. It has all of the vehicles and the higher vehicles as well. So I kind of am beginning to realize this in a way that I have not before. I have oftentimes said that Saturn is the mental body of this third ray life. Three planets constitute the personality of each ray life. Well, I think we'll have to leave it a little ambiguous. Saturn has its mental body, its own, and the ray life has its own mental body. And the Sun has its own mental body, which is not the mental body of any of its planets or of the, in this case, let's say the three persons of the Logoic Trinity. They all have their own mental bodies, but the particular vehicles can be correlated with and resonant to other vehicles. For instance, the vehicles of Saturn and the vehicles of a person of the Trinity, if let's say we're dealing with the mental body of the solar logos, it can work through other expressions, other vehicles. So anyway, the personality of this third ray life, which may be independent of the three planets, functions through the following planets. The mental body expresses itself through the medium of the planet Saturn, and we are not told told which vehicles of Saturn receive the influence of the mental body of this third ray life. And then, oh, how about spelling that? The astral body expresses itself through the planet Mars, but it's still the astral body of the third ray life, of the third ray life. And the physical body expresses itself through our planet Earth. Is Earth the physical body, or does the physical body of this being express through Earth? I think we'll have to leave that for the moment unresolved. But let's just say there is a great connection between this life and these three planets, and similarly, the potency of this life is such that he requires three complete schemes, all three closely allied and interdependent, through which to express himself. Uranus, Jupiter, and Venus are similarly allied in order to manifest or express a great life, probably a parallel life, and I assume here that we are speaking of a second ray life. Well, Venus having so much to do with the second ray, and Jupiter as well, and Uranus being in the Sirian line, being a conduit for Sirian energy and for the second aspect of divinity in general, I assume this to be a second ray life, or I assume it to be the Sun aspect of the three persons of the Logoic Trinity. These facts constitute a tremendous mystery and in no way negate the truth that Venus has a peculiar and intimate relation to the Earth. The different planets in our solar system have many relations, just the way we as human beings relate not only to one person and one function, but have many different relationships. The point here being stressed is difficult to express, but of great importance. And now he's going to be more explicit. Well, I think what I'm going to do at this point is make this an hour and a half program. So this will be the end of Laws of the Soul webinar commentaries, number 5, Esoteric Psychology 2, page. Oh, well, is it 101 or is it, no, it's page 99. And beginning with Laws of the Soul, webinar commentaries from EP2, page 99, and it will be number 6. Well, we're into deep things. We're into the law of sacrifice, and we're into the manner in which sacrifice is experienced and expressed on different planets, and we've enter the realm of a third ray entity, a stupendous life, and three planets familiar to us through which this great third ray entity expresses. And I think he's going to tell us that there's a very heavy expression of the law of sacrifice on these three planets, and most of all on Earth, which maybe to us as Earthlings comes as no surprise. We think our lot is rather hard, and in fact, esoterically, it is. When we are identified with the third aspect of divinity, we have to realize that this third aspect has much to do to correlate itself with the program, the agenda of the second aspect of divinity working through our particular solar system. And in that frictional adjustment comes much of our pain. Well, okay, that will be it for this, and we will go on to number 6 and continue looking at these great lives, which I am presuming to be expressions of three great lords found, we might say, here. The three Logoi. I assume these are the three persons of the Logoic Trinity, and they are the manner of bringing the one of the solar logos into the three and thence into the seven, which would be the seven sacred planets. So what I'm saying here, it's a hypothesis, is that each one of these Logoi, the three persons of the Logoic Trinity, require three of the other planetary Logoi through which to express. And, of course, on this monadic plane as well will be the presence of the monads of the non-sacred planets. Well, let's just say that this is really the monads of the non-sacred planets are found on a very high level, but the type of expression found here is, I think, not limited to the sacred planets only, but some sort of expression relative to Earth, to Mars, to Pluto, and so forth will also be found here. It says these are the seven planetary Logoi. Usually they are considered the sacred ones. And when it says the three Logoi, it seems like too expansive a statement. If we were to relate the three Logois, three Logoi, to the three sacred planets, and remembering that the three sacred planets, at least two of them, are among the threefold personality expressions of these greater ray lives. And indeed, the three persons of the Logoic Trinity are great ray lives, representing the first, second, and third rays. So for the time being, we have a hypothesis here, and we will learn over time of the extent of its accuracy. All right, we'll let this go for now, and we'll see you with number 6. See you then.